Hi, and welcome to the Indexical Podcast. I'm Michael Masaru Flora, and this episode features musician Dominic Coles. His composition and improvisation practices investigate the interactions of place, personhood, and power as they are articulated in sound and speech. I'm happy to have as our guest today, artist and musician Dominic Coles. Hi.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. We're recording this interview sort of as a pregame to tonight's concert.
Love to pregame.
December 6th, 2024. We have a concert tonight with Dominic Coles presenting a new piece, and we'll play excerpts of that concert interleaved with this interview.
Awesome.
So I guess, you know, we've been friends for a couple of years now, you know, definitely a fan of your music, but I don't think I ever asked you what your background is with music. How'd you get into music?
Yeah. My older brother is an amazing musician as well. And when I was little, he was sort of starting out on the jazz guitar. And, you know, in a kind of like classic younger brother kind of way, I had to be doing everything that he was doing. Yeah. And so I also started playing the guitar. So my first kind of musical, you know, explorations were through the guitar and specifically through jazz music. And he introduced me to a lot of different kinds of jazz, actually. So very quickly, I think just through, you know, the internet and probably his own research, we found ourselves listening to like late Coltrane and then also a lot of Eric Dolphy. And I remember I have this very particular memory of him. Like, we didn't know what Eric Dolphy sounded like, but also, like, we weren't, like, searching on the computer, and we didn't have access to a computer in the way that, like, we could just go, like, I don't think YouTube existed, and so we weren't, like, on YouTube searching for videos of Eric Dolphy, but someone had told my brother to listen to that Mingus record, Mingus at Antibes, and there's an unbelievable Eric Dolphy solo on the first track. And we were like, well, which one is he? Which one of these solos is he? And there was this incredible moment of, like, I remember listening to it with him, and then Eric Dolphy comes in, and you're like, oh, that's Eric Dolphy.
Wow.
And so I was being introduced to all of this amazing jazz music through my brother and was studying jazz guitar. And I did that through high school and sort of in parallel, I think through getting interested in more kind of like free jazz music, also found myself listening to a lot of more kind of like avant-garde European classical composition, having read that like Cecil Taylor is like studying the Stockhausen Klavierstück, and like I didn't know anything about that music, and then, you know, would like spend a bunch of time on Wikipedia reading about those people and sort of just found my way to all of this music, and would go to the music library at the New York Public Library and would like take out scores and stuff. So I started like getting really into composition and kind of specifically that avant-garde European classical music.
This is still in high school.
That was in high school.
Wow.
Yeah. And so kind of at that point I was like, oh, I want to be a composer, which is so insane. I was a really weird teenager. And when I encountered that music, It was a really extreme reaction, because I think I was like, oh, this is so clarifying. I want to write music like this. But I think that it created a kind of divergence for me, which was that all of my performance and like performance life was in jazz guitar. And it it made clear in some way that, like, I was having a difficulty figuring out a way forward with the jazz guitar as the primary tool through which, like, a compositional idea could be expressed. And so at that moment, it felt like there was this, which saddens me now because I ended up giving up the guitar in the way that I was playing it at the time. I still play, but it's really a personal practice. And, you know, I'm not practicing or performing on it in the way that I used to. But yeah, there was this feeling that there were all these compositional ideas that I was becoming interested in and formal ideas that somehow couldn't be filtered through the medium of, like, the jazz standards, which is what I was the only language I felt like I had access to on the guitar. Even though I was listening to all this free jazz, the training was quite conservative feeling that I was receiving. And so it felt like a real conundrum. Like, I wanted to make a kind of music that I just couldn't envision happening on the guitar. And so more and more I found myself being drawn to composition.
So it obviously sounds like you were sort of like moving towards like formally wanting to study composition. So you leave high school and then you went to college, right?
Yeah, I went to undergrad for music and okay. I studied composition. So my background, I guess that, yeah, is all an elaborate lead up to going to undergrad and studying composition. And, you know, having a similar reaction to what I had with the guitar with composition, which was like very quickly finding that it wasn't a conservatory, but that, like, whatever it was that I thought was possible within the space of the concert hall and with classical music was very quickly revealed to, I don't know, not be possible, or was not a priority for the people that I was finding myself around so much. And luckily within the school, actually it was kind of split. There was like a school of music and a department of music, and the department of music was filled with people who were interested in the kinds of things that I was finding myself gravitating towards. And so there was a person who taught like a electronics class and like Max MSP, and I found my way to the computer through that. And there was this sound studies person, Brian Kane, who writes a lot about acousmatic music, and Pierre Schaeffer. And being around them kind of quickly also reoriented a lot of stuff where I was like, oh, I don't know that a traditional composition situation is exactly it either. But I found myself introduced to all of this music that I had never encountered before. And through them, it primarily learned about like Cage and Feldman and American experimental music, which was revelatory to me at the time.
Awesome. And so you're in college now. Did you move like away to go to school?
Yeah,
or stay near home?
I was in New Haven, which is not too far from New York. So okay. I would sort of commute back to see my family and go to concerts and stuff. But yeah, New Haven has an awesome music scene as well. And so encountering Braxton for the first time, and all of the people who were involved in the Tricentric Foundation, and also like great DIY music scene as well. So it was amazing. I found myself around all of this music that I had never heard before. Imagine possible.
Wow. Yeah, that's impressive. I'm curious, you know, because it sounds like initially you were attracted to the guitar, and you were playing guitar as a performer, and then you kind of got into composition. I wonder if part of your interest in electronic music is oftentimes with electronic music, like the producer is both a performer and a composer?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that funnily, the draw to electronics became, in a kind of way, a certain reaction to also the experience of studying composition, where, I mean, it was twofold. There were, I think that I was increasingly finding myself within the acoustic music I was writing drawn to, like, working with extended techniques and certain kinds of more noise-based structures emerging from, you know, a more unruly use of the acoustic instrument. But those sounds, those kinds of sounds that I was finding myself drawn to within the acoustic instrument felt very, very quickly accessible with the computer. And so there was a sort of material draw to the computer where I felt like, oh yeah, these sounds are much more accessible to me. Whereas, like, actually I don't have a cello or something, and I don't play the cello, and that's, I, like, it was much harder for me to access that material somehow. And then I think it was also a compositional thing where, like, you know, I could make a sound on the computer so quickly and then start generating all of this material, and then these structures and then forms resulting from those sounds very quickly, as opposed to this process of sort of like imagining how the sounds would be and writing them down on paper and then waiting and hoping that I could cobble together friends or people or somehow find myself in a situation where someone would play the piece. And often that didn't happen. So I didn't have the sense that I was hearing any of the work. And so I think the draw to the electronics was that I actually, like, felt in control of the performance.
Are you familiar with the composer and he's sort of a technologist, Alberto De Campo?
Oh, I've heard the name before. I don't really know his work,
he's
though.
I think he's sort of like a super collider guy. And I believe this is quoted to him. He says the computer is like the new folk instrument. You know, I think the idea is that a lot of people have computers nowadays. They're very common, and its potential for use for like art making or music practice is, you know, especially with like free software and stuff like that, it's just kind of very open-ended. You don't need to have a traditional acoustic instrument. You already like have this music instrument device at home that you're using to write your biology report.
Yeah, totally. And I love that. That's such an interesting part of it too, is it's this multi-purpose tool where it's like, I think there's this I think it was this like Holly Herndon TED talk that I saw when I was like 19 or something. And she said something that really stuck with me, that was like, the computer is somehow like one of the more intimate musical instruments, because like you're making music on it, and then you're like sending all of your emails and correspondence, and like every aspect of your life seems to be mediated through it. Yeah, so I don't know, like the musical thing, it's just like to the right of your like email app or whatever. And it's all mixed together.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, I think I've heard that quote as well. That's pretty funny. So you're in college, you're getting into the computer as an instrument. Are you starting to like, you know, perform or play out at this time?
Yeah, a little bit. There were spaces at the school that you could sort of like very quickly just like book to do performances in. And my friends and I would like play each other's pieces and also do like a lot of improvising in these spaces. But it was pretty insular, like within the school. And it was also very like probably more academic feeling. But was this important exploratory thing for me? And I was trying to figure out a way to both compose with the computer and maybe improvise with the computer, or trying to figure out what my relationship with composition maybe even was. I ended up going for more school after undergrad and studied like electronic music. And
do you have like a PhD or DMA?
No,
or?
It's like an MA kind of MA thing. And that was where I met Michelle.
Okay, Michelle Liu.
Yeah, Michelle Liu was teaching in the program.
And you met Hunter Brown there?
And that's
well?
Where I met Hunter and Stefan as well.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So many
okay.
of the important people in my life I met in that program, which is so amazing. That's where I met Andrew, actually, as
really?
Well. Yeah, because
Andrew,
Andrew was super good friends with Bo, who also started
yes.
Indexical. And
that's right.
They were, Bo was my roommate at the program.
Bo Sievers.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a small world.
I know, it's tiny. But yeah, so that felt like the time where everything kind of focused. And I started to sort of understand how the computer could function compositionally more for me. And I was improvising a lot. I had developed this instrument and Super Collider that I was kind of making a lot of my compositions with, and then also using as an instrument to improvise with. And, you know, we lived in the woods in New Hampshire, and there was nothing to do at all. And
is this how you started your project with Hunter?
Exactly. So we would meet
Other Plastics.
Yeah, at least every Friday, and spend basically like the entire night playing together. That was great. I mean, it was the thing that kept me going probably through that time. But yeah, so
and you recorded an album together. Did that come out of these like Friday night sessions?
Exactly, yeah. So our first record I think is compiled from those recordings, and then Hunter spent one summer living in New York, and so we were hanging and recording all the time then. And so we just had this bucket loads of material. We're like, well, we should cut it down into some kind of release document thing. But yeah, that was the start of Hunter and me playing together a lot.
And is Other Plastics still?
Yeah, very, very much. I mean, we have a trio now that feels like, in a certain way, an extension of that, with TJ Borden, which is this group Technical Reserve. Mm-hmm. And I think that Hunter and I were, you know, almost in a kind of like free improvisation context with electronics or the computer or something, and then slowly kind of started just composing pieces together, which is what we were talking about that the other night, where, you know, these, like the piece we did here a few years ago was this piece we had composed.
Right, and then that was released on your own, on the
on
label,
Party Perfect,
right?
with the release with you and Michelle and Stefan.
Yeah.
And
I'm so lucky to be included.
Oh,
on that.
My
I wasn't
God.
Part of your cohort.
Yeah, exactly.
Or college experience.
God. We wish you had been, Michael.
I wish I could have been there.
So funnily, I feel like Other Plastics has turned into an almost like a conventional vehicle, which is that like Hunter and I think have all these ideas for pieces that we want to make. But then don't find ourselves in the same place for an extended period of time enough to like actualize them. Yeah, we've been improvising a lot in this different configuration, but hopefully we'll have some time together soon to like actually make the music we've been imagining for a sec.
And then what about your solo practice? Was it in 2020 you had a release on Wandelweiser?
Oh, in 2021, yeah.
2021.
It's funny because as of now, or increasingly, it feels like some of the solo work is sort of moving in a different direction from some of the other things that I've been working on for some time. A lot of my solo work deals with speech and the voice. I've always been interested in the voice and speech and narrative. You know, I remember hearing Robert Ashley's music in undergrad for the first time and being particularly affected by that. And I don't know, I guess that increasingly I'm thinking about the situation in which there's all this music that like, well, yeah, I don't know. It's because I guess that there is this thought that speech and music, they seem to be affecting similar structures in our brain or activating similar structures in our brain. And so I think that there is lots of music that actually very effectively makes that imbrication between speech and music. Through musical form, you come to hear speech as music. And I guess that I wasn't so aware of music that was operating in the opposite direction, that tried to give you the perceptual experience of music potentially operating as speech. I think that some of Peter Oblinger's work, and there are some James Tenney pieces that also investigate. For the Tenney and Barlow, it's much more kind of like almost like a frequency rendering of the voice in acoustic instruments. And so it ends up feeling very abstract, but it creates these super interesting sonic structures, but it's not necessarily like the feeling of experiencing speech. And the Oblinger in Voices and Piano gets quite close to my ears, and that the association between the piano and the voice ends up, at least when the voice cuts out, giving the experience, the perceptual experience, that in some way the piano is continuing this speech that maybe you don't quite understand. I became very interested in the possibility that like musical sounds could become indexes for semantic content in some way, and that, you know, our brains and our cognitions are so malleable that like maybe in part what music can do is make available to us other kinds of cognition that we are practicing all the time, like language acquisition and our ability to just associate things more generally, but in a very different kind of way through music.
Yeah, because you have this interest in language and music and their cognitive origins. Have you sort of like researched or looked into, you know, the brain and how it works? And
yeah, I'm just doing sort of like...
Or is it more of like an artistic practice?
I think it's a combo of just like doing sort of, you know, research on my own into these things. And also, you know, my friend Kieran is super into these kinds of reading too, and is an amazing researcher. And so he sends me articles about like music in the brain and pretty frequently too, which have been really useful. But that kind of research is sort of like, I don't feel at home in science at all. So it's very I don't know. It's very just me trying to read and parse these things that are not my... really the space that I find myself thinking in too much. But I think that for me, it comes from a very particular artistic place, which is that like, one, the goal of this work was in some way to experience sound in a new way, in a way that I hadn't before, which was as speech or something, trying to communicate directly. And so this research is with the intention of hearing anew. And I think that for me, this has kind of the function that a lot of art has, which is that like when we experience something new perceptually or aesthetically, we come to recognize that the things that we have experienced and assumed to be natural elements of music making are often actually just historical things where we're like enculturated to hear them as a given, but they've been developed over time and made by people to be the way that they are. And that feeling of like hearing something new is maybe just the suggestion that like, oh, the thing can be changed and is malleable and flexible. And that seems to, I don't know, like have an exciting possibility where like, oh, if sound can make me experience something as changeable, then like what else in the world might be,
and you're calling this practice alphabetic listening.
Yeah.
And so you had a record come out called Alphabets.
Uh-huh.
Where you kind of put this into practice. You know, you wrote me a little description of your newest piece called Alphabet 2, where you said that the piece you will hear develops a type of listening I've been calling alphabetic listening. It works like this. Each word taken from a larger phrase is associated with an abstract synthetic sound. And the alphabet is developed in the sound, and through repetition, the association between the word and the sound is reinforced so that you can continue the association once the voice has been removed. In essence, will you continue to hear voices that no longer speak in these abstract sounds? Put another way, can music be experienced as speech?
Mind
control
makes
me
mind control
makes
me
mind
control
makes
me
mind
control
makes me.
Yeah, the first Alphabets piece was a real, are almost like three studies in this process, where basically the Vondelweiser record was an attempt to sort of use the voice to activate all of these sound structures that I was interested in. So the voice is essentially translated through the synthesizer and like the computer processor in the Super Collider program to generate the sound structures, and then several readings were gone over and kind of interconnected to create each piece, which is kind of like an electronic translation or something. And that then I started making all these pieces after that, where the text and the synthetic translation would sort of be juxtaposed in different ways. And someone said to me that like I should try to experiment with having them occur at the same time and what that would be like. And that piece was a study that didn't really lead anywhere except to this question of like, oh, when the two become so associated, the sound actually seems to have the possibility of absorbing the semantic content of the word. And so on having, yeah, that idea, those first three Alphabets pieces were sort of like studies in order to do that. And so there are two much shorter ones, and they just sort of, over the course of their form, just envelop the word into the sounds, which keep repeating. And then the much larger one sort of teaches you a single phrase and then takes those sounds and those speech associated sounds and puts them in contact with other musical sounds, so ones that you don't necessarily think are attached to a voice. And the piece becomes a kind of memory game, I think, in a way where like it's trying to see if you can keep that trace of the word or the voice that's on the sound as it makes contact with all these new pieces of information or new musical materials. And so this piece is slightly different in that it takes the single phrase and mind control makes me, and it associates it with a single set of sounds, which are of a much simpler kind of synthetic or quality than some of the sounds I was working with in that initial Alphabets piece. And so I think my hope is that these sounds become much more of a clear indicator of the structure of the piece, and it becomes easier to follow. And then, you know, instead of putting these sounds in contact with other musical materials, instead those speech associated sounds become kind of like the only material that is subsequently developed into music. So all of the musical sections that follow take those abstract speech associated sounds and develop their music out of them. And I guess, you know, this piece also sort of like develops a different kind of thinking about the process. I had some very interesting kinds of feedback after performing that piece a bunch, and I think that, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about, lots of things after, yeah, the making of that piece, and one thing was
the original Alphabets piece.
Yeah, the original Alphabets piece. And one thing was this, you know, to make that piece, there had to be this sort of like pedagogical section at the front of the piece that teaches you the associations between the words and the sounds before it could then go into a kind of like musical elaboration of those sounds. And I started thinking about how every piece of music has this pedagogical function in it in some way, insofar as like every piece of music is trying to teach us how to listen to it. It's trying to show us how to listen to its materials as they're elaborated over time. And then at the same time, depending on the context of that music, thinking about, you know, the Western Classical Concert Hall and its various simulacra, that pedagogical function also maybe has a disciplinary function insofar as the music might actually be trying to enforce a certain kind of listening and make the listener hear in a given way. And, you know, I think that some people, interestingly, would come to me afterwards and be like, that start of the piece, it's almost like mind control or brainwashing or something. And I found that so interesting that like this pedagogical aspect of music when brought to the fore seemed to speak to something more generally about like political consensus building or something that that was just in the structure of the music. And so I wanted to make a piece that would speak to that, but also to this thing where like, you know, our senses are incredibly capacious and they're always reading and mediating and operating in different ways. And each listener also brings their own self-discipline to the listening situation, you know, based on their history and their desires and sound, such that like there is always something to be heard beyond what is enforced by a piece of music. And so I'm kind of interested in this situation where like, a piece of music might try to enforce a certain kind of listening, and then what choices become available to us in the wake of that disciplinary function operating on us. I think that within the Alphabets piece, there is this interesting thing which will vary from listen to listen. Like if you listen repeatedly to it or you know, spend a lot of time with it, you might have a different sense of this duration, but there is a duration that's inaudible projected by the work potentially, which is that the amount of time that it takes for the association between the word and the abstract sound to fade into non-meaning. And so at what point does that non-meaning occur for each listener? And then what decisions are available to them once that enforcement has faded? And I don't know. I think that there are interesting possibilities in this experience of like realizing the disciplinary function that is maybe present in lots of kinds of music that we encounter, and then having to make choices about what it is that we want to hear, whether it's continuing with this thing that was taught to us or following our ears to some other place that interests us and excites us.
I feel like that was almost like a good way to
tie the knot.
Yeah, unless there's like anything else you want
no
talk about or like tag on to that.
Not so much. I hope I didn't ramble too much. I want to talk about your music too now.
No. Nobody wants to hear that. That's for the next Party Perfect Z.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Cool. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. It's been great talking to you.